Welcome, I'm Bernice Heilbrun, your new host for New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm speaking today to Anne-Marie O'Connor, author of The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. In her book about Gustav Klimt's portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer and its eventual recovery by her niece Maria Altman, O'Connor takes us on an engaging tour of Fin de Siècle Vienna, the world of art and Jewish high society during an era when the mores of an old empire clashed with the new world of Sigmund Freud. From there, she takes us through the period of Nazi rule and ultimately to the 1990s in Los Angeles, when Maria Altman joined with the determined young attorney Randall Schoenberg to recover the art that was rightfully hers. The iconic Klimt portrait that O'Connor tracks from its creation through its theft to its ultimate recovery was then famously acquired by philanthropist Ronald Lauder and now anchors the collection of the Neue Gallery on Fifth Avenue in New York City. The portrait comes alive in O'Connor's writing. Her book brings into focus issues in the news today, particularly questions surrounding restitution of works of art of national importance and artwork plundered during the Holocaust. Now, let me welcome Anne-Marie O'Connor. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Good. Oh, it's our pleasure. Could you please tell our listeners a bit about your background?
Yes, I am a reporter of several decades. I started covering the wars in Central America in the 1980s in El Salvador and Nicaragua. I had studied art as an art student, so I came to reporting with that background. I moved to Los Angeles to be a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and did a mix of investigative and arts reporting and also magazine pieces.
Great. So you bring unique skills to this book. How did you come to write The Lady in Gold?
Well, I was in Los Angeles covering a variety of things, politics and profiles and more of a cultural beat. And one day I was reading a newspaper, a community newspaper of the West Side in Los Angeles. And they had a very small item in the newspaper about a local woman who was trying to get back a painting of her aunt. And in those days, no one got back stolen art. So I looked at it. You know, it was one of those cases, like many in Los Angeles, that weren't going to go anywhere. But then I saw this postage stamp size image of this painting, and I thought, oh, my God, that painting? It was a very famous painting. One of Gustav Klimt's wealthy, decadent society women, or at least I had been told that in art history class many years before. So I called 411 and got Maria Altman's number. She invited me over. She answered the door, and Maria Altman was a tremendously charismatic woman. She sat me down and made me Viennese coffee with lots and lots of whipped cream, which I gather is some kind of key to longevity among Viennese centenarians. And she told me this amazing story about Gustav Klimt and these enigmatic women. According to Maria, these women were not boring society women. They were intellectuals, kind of lady existentialists. They were friends of Klimt. Her aunt may have even had a thing with Klimt. Her aunt was the subject of this very famous portrait, Klimt's gold portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, one of his most famous paintings. And according to Maria, these women were also Jewish. Which is why she was trying to get back the portrait of her aunt that had been stolen by the Nazis. And according to her, some of the other portraits had been stolen, too. This blew my mind. This contradicted anything I'd ever heard about the famous portraits of women by Gustav Klimt. So I was really intrigued by this, and I listened to her, and I thought, could this all possibly be true?
Wow, good. I'd like you to set up this conversation now for our listeners by reading an excerpt. Would you read a few words to set the stage for our listeners now?
Sure. I'll start at the beginning. The Belvedere Palace of war hero Prince Eugene seemed the setting of a fairy tale on the winter morning in 2006 when a young Los Angeles attorney, wearing a long black coat and an habitual air of impatience, trudged through its snowy gardens to lay claim to a painting he had spent years fighting for. The lone man strode briskly along the Imperial Palace's frozen pond. Ice clung to the monumental sphinxes standing sentinel along his path, their hair swirling around fiercely beautiful faces, breasts naked between tassels dangling from armor. Their eyes cast a bold gaze of fated conquest. The lawyer was Randall Schoenberg, the grandson of a venerated Viennese composer who had fled the rise of Hitler. The return of this ominous heir was anything but welcome. The painting Schoenberg sought was a shimmering gold masterpiece painted a century earlier by the artistic heretic Gustav Klimt. It was a portrait of a Viennese society beauty, Adele Bloch-Bauer. Both artist and model were long dead, but people still enjoyed speculating they had been lovers. Their artistic collaboration produced one of the greatest portraits of the modern age. Austrians regarded the painting as their Mona Lisa. Schoenberg lifted the first painting in the rack, and the light caught a shimmering surface. Here was the masterpiece Schoenberg was fighting for. He stared in wonder at Adele's face, floating in a haze of gold, as pale and sultry as a diva of the silent screen. For 8 years, Schoenberg had argued this painting did not belong to Austria. Most people would have given up long ago, but Schoenberg had a remarkable client with a stubbornness to match his own. A 90-year-old retired dress shop owner, disarmingly charming, and as dignified and composed as the carefully cultivated Viennese debutante she had once been. This one-time Vienna belle, Maria Bloch-Bauer Altman, was the last living link to her aunt Adele, who was the muse, and perhaps much more, of Gustav Klimt.
Thank you. And for our listeners, let me, as an aside, mention at this point that in addition to printed book form, this book is available as an audiobook for those who like to listen to their books. Now, from that prologue that you read us an excerpt from, and I would have loved you to go on forever, it's really sets the stage for the book. From this prologue, you reveal a very intimate knowledge of present-day events and attitudes in Vienna, as well as taking us back more than 100 years. So how did you acquire the information about current-day Vienna?
I spent a lot of time in Vienna. You know, when I first met Maria, I was very intrigued by all the names that she mentioned that were involved in the story, like Sigmund Freud, Arthur Schnitzler, I'd never heard of him, and Marlene Dietrich and Hedy Lamarr, who was a debutante with Maria, whose name was Hedwig Kiesler in those days. I wasn't an expert on Vienna. Vienna in the old days or contemporary Vienna. So I really had to read up on it. What I had most heard about was the scandal involving the presidential candidate and eventual president Kurt Waldheim. I spent a lot of time in Vienna because I wanted to really capture the Viennese character. So I went on long visits to Vienna for as long as 7 weeks and rented an apartment and just really tried to soak up the Vienna atmosphere and socialize with some of the protagonists. And, in the case of Austrian government officials, they weren't initially receptive. So I just tried to cultivate them and get to know them so that we could talk about the story and they could help me. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And that's all really adds to the account that you provide for your readers. Let's turn to explore some of the key parts of the book now. Your book is in three parts, each one with a provocative title. Part one is Emancipation. So let's start with this era in which the portrait was painted in Fin de Siècle Vienna from around 1898 to just before the First World War. Could you describe this era when Adele Bloch-Bauer chose to sit for her portrait with Gustav Klimt? You talk about it as a time of dichotomies and dissonances, particularly for women and for Jews.
This was just one of the most fascinating, dynamic times to be alive. This was what people refer to as the birth of modernism. This was a time when immigration of Jewish residents of the empire into Vienna was bringing all these talented minds into the city. Now, the title Emancipation refers to the Jewish emancipation. Before the Jewish emancipation, which was codified into law in the 1860s, but really began in the 1840s, these Jewish families were very restricted in where they could live and where they could work. Now, under Emperor Franz Joseph, he began to change these restrictions and loosen them and allow Jewish families to move into Vienna. The families of Freud, of Gustav Mahler, of many brilliant people, moved them into Vienna, and suddenly there was a cosmopolitan mix of new people with new ideas who had much more open minds about art, about women, about many things that in Vienna were really set in stone in those days because of the aristocracy was so traditional. And one of those things that was absolutely set in stone was art. The Viennese museums would not show the new art. In Paris and in other cities, they were beginning to bring the modern art into the academy, but not in Vienna. And this group of people was very key to Gustav Klimt, to supporting him in this new art that modernists like him were beginning to create.
You describe wealthy Jewish industrialists and their families, among them Adele's father and her husband-to-be. Who were these people, and what was life like for them?
Well, you know, they had grown up taking a lot of prejudice for granted. But this was before a lot of people's prejudices would hold them back. So this was a time when they moved to Vienna where it was exciting for them, too, because prejudice still existed. The mayor of Vienna, Karl Luger, was a famous anti-Semite. But at this point, a lot of the prejudices weren't holding them back. They were there, but they were more in the background, and they were empowered by Emperor Franz Joseph and by other figures at that time in the empire to conduct their lives and to start to become much fuller citizens in Vienna. And one of the symbolic elements of that was that they could build homes on this famous Ringstrasse. The new Ringstrasse that was put up in place of the wall that the emperor tore down around Vienna, it created this enormous space of land where they could build big mansions. So in these mansions, they began to fill them with this new art.
Great. Thanks. Now, let's talk for a moment about the artist Gustav Klimt. You write that Klimt was king of the Vienna art world. Could you talk a bit about Klimt and his background and poverty, his Jewish patrons, and his claim to fame?
Klimt was a very intriguing person. He was from a very poor background. He was an outsider. His father spoke very bad German. His father was Czech. Klimt was from a poor Catholic family. Many members of his family were mentally ill. His mother suffered from depression. Most of his sisters were mentally ill in one way or another, either depressed or, in one case, one of his sisters was delusional. Only one of his sisters would ever marry. This was a family that was under tremendous stress. He had to drop out of school when he was in his early teens to help support the family. Luckily, he was brilliant and very, very talented. And he went to an applied arts academy, not the real fine arts academy in Vienna, but a more sort of decorative arts academy. And a teacher took him under his wing. and got him commissioned to paint beautiful decorative art murals in palaces and theaters throughout the empire. He did these with his brother. Now, they became successful very young. By their late teens, they were already very much in demand. They were both very, very handsome men. And in an ordinary world in Vienna, someone of their social class would not be accepted into high society there. But their looks and their talent began to trump their social background. And their mother had wanted to be an opera singer. So their family was also cultured. So they were part of a very early meritocracy in Vienna of bohemians and intellectuals and artists who were getting along on their talent and not the fact that they had a title or they were baronesses or the other ways where Vienna society was established. So these people naturally melded into the new avant-garde Jewish intelligentsia that Adele Bloch-Bauer's family came from. Now, there was an established Jewish aristocracy represented by the Rothschilds and the Abruzzis and other families in Vienna. This was a different milieu. They were newer. They had newer ideas. They collected newer art. And Gustav Klimt found his social niche in their circle, particularly among the women in his circle, who tended to be more intellectual than aristocratic Catholic girls of that era. They were involved in learning. There was an inheriting system in those days in the empire, which gave the firstborn boy the control of the family assets, something like that in Downton Abbey. But among this Jewish elite, fathers gave substantial inheritances to girls. And this gave them a certain amount of freedom to cultivate themselves and a certain amount of independence. So this was the milieu Klimt found himself in.
So you situate Klimt in a sexually charged time. Let me ask you a bit of a provocative question, suggested also by what you shared in the prologue about the relationship, the speculation about the relationship between Klimt and Adele Bloch-Bauer. You described the period in Vienna as sexually charged and extending from the emperor at one end of the social spectrum all the way through to the common man in Vienna, including, of course, Sigmund Freud, who's at this point has published Interpretation of Dreams and is active. You describe Klimt as an artist with several affairs running simultaneously, including more than one illegitimate child. With this reputation, why did Adele and her friends seek to have their portraits painted by him in the seclusion of his house?
Well, I think for this group of women, Klimt was considered a genius. His erotic drawings were notorious, but they were a rare acknowledgement of female sexuality at a time when nice women weren't supposed to enjoy sex. Mm-hmm. I think some Viennese, not just these women, probably fantasized about him and what he was like in bed. I think at that time he was extremely handsome and charismatic. You know, he might have been a little bit like a Mick Jagger figure where he was a big celebrity and a very intriguing man. Mm-hmm. Another aspect was he was risque. A lot of the aristocratic families wouldn't have wanted their daughters, particularly the maiden daughters, anywhere near his reputation of seducing his mom. But for these families, these progressive Jewish families, Klimt was risque, but also very prestigious, a real status symbol. It was kind of like having a Warhol portrait done in the 1960s in New York.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Thanks. Now let's talk about the portrait that's the subject of this book. You describe it as where Vienna's glittering past met its fratricidal present, And you also write that it's, quote, a painting with the flourish of Mozart, yet a product of Freud's emerging age of the psyche. What do you mean?
Well, one of the things that distinguished Klimt's portraits in the eyes of art historians is that the psychology that is projected and emotions on these women's faces, they're not like Sargent Singer or other portraits in which women are a little bit more passive and where you kind of, they, even though you don't see the men in their lives, they're somewhere off stage. There's a wealthy husband or a prominent father who commissioned these portraits. Klimt's portraits are really about the women themselves and their own story. And there's a tremendous amount of restlessness in the eyes of many of his women. And what one Viennese expert on Klimt, Tobias Natter, calls, in the case of Adele Bloch-Bauer, a restlessness on about her gender role. These are women who seem to want more in a society that wants them to be less. In Adele's painting, she is literally sort of surrounded by gold. She's in a gilded cage, or she seems to be pinned down by gold, and her face is floating. Some people said in those days, one journalist said of Klimt that he invented the siren of film. So the flourish of Mozart, when Klimt is one of the painters in Vienna that really made the transition into modernism. Unlike Egon Schiele, he didn't start from a modern position. He started in decorative art. So he brought all of this with him when he started to sort of push more into modernist images. So he had, the painting is so ornate. It has all of the gold of Vienna. Vienna is a place where a lot of things are gilded. If you walk around Vienna, you can see globes and spears and all kinds of things are gilded. It's an ornamentation that they really love there. He brought all this with him into his modernism. He brought Vienna's past into the present.
That is so interesting. It's great how you have access to your background in art and can use that to enrich this account for us. Let's talk a bit about Adele Bloch-Bauer. You've already shared something about her with us, about her and her milieu. There's more to her, of course, than her portrait. As you show us in the book, you write that she had existential concerns, and you describe her Red Saturday salons where she held court talking about her particular views. Could you tell us a little, and of course this is what her niece Marie Altman, I guess, remembered about her aunt too, her Red Salons and her different views about politics and life. Could you tell us a little about that?
Well, Adele was very modern for that age. I mean, she called herself a Buddha. She was a reformer. She was very focused on trying to get modern Viennese art into the big museums, into the Belvedere. She was very concerned that the modern art that she loved get the recognition that she felt that it deserved. And in her case, that was the paintings of Gustav Klimt. But she was a reformer in other ways. She was part of a group of people that was trying to get vaccinations for children and public kindergartens and schools for kids, which at that time, the public education and health system was just being formed in Vienna. Women had just gotten the vote when she was having these salons. And women would change politics in Vienna in those days and help a social reformer get elected as Chancellor of Austria, Karl Renner. Now, she was very active. However, her friends were intellectuals, One of them was a famous writer, Goethe Zuckerkunzel, a pioneer journalist in that age. Another was the first woman who went to the medical school. She had to dress as a man. These were very brave women. Now, Adele, like a lot of people, wasn't willing to sacrifice everything to really go all the way. She had a friend who had affair after an affair, Alma Mahler, and who married one distinguished man after another, but Alma Mahler was really willing to roll the dice and risk herself. And I think Adele probably wanted to be more than who she was, than just a living room intellectual. But having said that, she actually distinguished herself very much for her day.
Interesting. So you describe her at one point as an unfinished woman. Is that what you meant, that she really didn't go all the way in terms of her pursuing her reform goals? I wasn't sure what you meant.
She died very young. She was only 43 when she died. We don't know what she would have become. But by all accounts, she was married to someone who she loved and respected but wasn't passionately in love with. Mm-hmm. And she never, although we found a letter of her, she may have bloomed as a writer and as a more publicly acknowledged intellectual who left a permanent legacy, but she didn't, from what we know. Mm-hmm. So, she was one of these people who moved society forward behind the scenes. And I think that that's still very common in this day. She did do a lot for her society, but she did it in a role that was less acknowledged. And reading the writings that she did leave behind, I think that she wanted to be more.
That's so interesting. And I know from my students, people are always surprised to see what women thought and accomplished at this period of time. It breaks their stereotypes of what women did. So this really adds to our understanding.
I think this is what happened to most women and also most men. But in the case of women, they face many more barriers still to this day. Mm-hmm. So I think that this also tends to be true. People start with these ambitions and then they settle for something less. We don't know who Adele would become had she lived longer. Mm-hmm.
Right. As you indicated, she died at 43 in 1925. And wishing to immortalize Klimt, she asked that her husband give their two portraits and four landscapes by Klimt to the Austrian Gallery. Her written disposition of her portrait and the absence of legal right of ownership by a wife become critical in the later fight over the famous portrait of her. How does this ultimately figure into the legal disposition of the Klimt? How does this writing by Adele Bloch-Bauer, and I'm not even sure if I should call it a will. I don't know if women had the legal authority to dispose of their property. What was this, a will that she left?
It was a will of sorts. She was asking Ferdinand after his death to donate the Klimt paintings to the Belvedere Museum. Now, according to what Austrian legal scholars concluded later, the paintings belonged to Ferdinand. He commissioned them. He paid for them. He was the owner of the paintings. Now, he did legally say that he would abide by her will. And at the time, they were both involved in an effort to get Klimt's paintings into the Belvedere. Ferdinand himself had paid to get one of Klimt's most experimental paintings, a painting called Medicine, to buy it and get it into the Belvedere Gallery. So they were both on board the same project. He had every intention to do this. The question that came up later was, if he was the owner, did she have any right to unilaterally donate those paintings. Now, there's really no evidence in the will that she intended to do that. She asked him to do this, and he said that he would. Later, he changed his mind, and that was the problem.
Mm-hmm. And this sets the stage for what we'll talk about in a few minutes when we talk about the recovery efforts. So this is really helpful. Let me move on then to part two of your book, which is captioned Love and Betrayal. After Adele's death, Ferdinand creates a sort of shrine for her in his home, as you describe it. Can you tell our listeners about it and why was this important?
Yeah, this was Ferdinand's memory room, he called it. He would go in a remembrance room. He would go and sit there and kind of meditate and think about her and think about art. He left a photograph of Gustav Klimt on her bedside table. It had been there for years. This was where Klimt where Ferdinand kind of enshrined the memory of his wife. He did have other women in his life after this, but he would never settle down again. His niece Luisa, he wanted a Buddha. In other words, the other women didn't measure up to the way that he idealized Adele.
So we have not only Adele and her friends, but Ferdinand as a very special figure who you really create for us here and help us to follow him through his life. He proves himself to be a dedicated supporter of the arts. And you describe his support for Kokoschka, who painted Ferdinand's portrait and, like Klimt, had largely Jewish patrons who were open to innovation. And through Kokoschka, you describe Ferdinand as quite aware and fearful of German anti-Semitism. What was the Germans' grasp of art and artists that was critical during this period?
Well, it's true that Ferdinand was much more sensitive than the rest of his family to the currents of anti-Semitism in Germany. Hitler had come to power in 1933. Very soon, the Germans began to pull down art that they considered degenerate from museum walls. And Hitler himself presided over the art show that resulted from degenerate art. There were many painters, including Kokoschka, that were seized during this period. Pretty much everybody good, Matisse, Picasso, in Germany. Now, Ferdinand, at this point, really stepped up to the plate. He showed that he was a very brave person. He sponsored this art show of Kokoschka, who was considered a degenerate in Germany at that moment, and he paid to extend the show so that they could show defiance in Vienna to this fascist trend that was building in Germany. The rest of his family really wasn't paying that much attention to this. The title, Love and Betrayal, refers to how they felt that they loved Vienna so much, and they felt like Vienna loved them back. And it was very surprising to them when they found that this love was somewhat unrequited.
Well, and life, in fact, then for Jews in Vienna becomes impossible with, especially after the 1938 Anschluss, when Austria is united with Germany. You describe how Ferdinand and their nieces suffered their property being seized, including their homes, their factories, even their musical instruments and their jewels. Maria Altman's husband is imprisoned in Dachau. Each family member has a unique story that you recount, and your account offers a fresh perspective, I'd say, on the Anschluss's impact on wealthy assimilated Jews in Vienna. What happens to Klimt's portraits of Adele and to Ferdinand's art collection?
Well, you know, the Nazis just went to his house. They opened it up. They invited all the museum directors in, and they just said to them, what do you want? They didn't want the Klimt painting. They wanted the Waldmuller's or the Biedermeier school paintings, or they wanted traditional art of paintings of aristocrats or of sort of bosomy Germanic looking women at beer halls, or pastorals, or they wanted things that were very traditional that Adele would have found to be kitsch. They weren't interested in the Klimt paintings. They passed them by and just left them in the house. They wanted paintings that represented Germanic values. So they took Ferdinand's most traditional pieces of art and then divided up among themselves for Hitler's Führer Museum in Linz as presents between Göring and other Nazis. And they left the Klimt paintings there. Now, several years later, the Nazi governor of Vienna, Walter von Schirach, was a huge fan of Gustav Klimt. And there was more interest in Klimt among the museum community. They started to look at where these Klimt paintings were around Vienna. And where did they find them? In the homes, Aryanized homes that had been seized from Jewish families. So eventually, an agent of Aryanization named Erich Spuhr, who was an SS officer, went over to Ferdinand's house and picked up the Klimt paintings. Everyone knew at that time that they were portraits of Jewish women. Then this was one of them. Klimt was known at that time as a philo-Semite and friend of Jews. Now, everybody knew this in Vienna, but Walter von Schirach loved Klimt, and not everyone knew this about Klimt in Berlin. Klimt could be, for the purposes of the Nazis in Vienna, he could be sort of cleansed of his philo-Semitic past and cast as a virile, handsome, Germanic Übermensch. His painting, the women were very beautiful. They were emblematic of Viennese society women. Klimt was an excellent draftsman, so the likenesses were very realistic. So his paintings could be shown as masterpieces of Viennese art, which they were, as long as they didn't tell people the names of these women, because they had been quite prominent in recent times, and they were Jewish. So they gave all the paintings anonymous names. Lady with Chinese wallpaper. Lady with flowers in the background. Lady in gold. And that was the portrait of Adele Blackwell. Mm-hmm.
And thus it was cleansed of its Jewish connection. Let's move on to part three, which you caption Atonement. Why the choice of Atonement for this chapter?
Well, because that was the question that was begged. The war ended, and I suppose there would be an expectation of atonement in the perfect world. Some contrition, some show of shame. Instead, after the war, many SS officers got pensions before Holocaust survivors. So Austria didn't go out of its way to help Jewish families who've been exiled. Many of them had lost their citizenship automatically because the survivors had left. Hitler had taken away their citizenship. They were forced to reapply. They came back. There was a lot of red tape to getting the property. The fact that they weren't citizens was held against them in some technical aspects. It was just really hostile red tape. And eventually, you know, some of them came back and tried to get what they could, but they went away. And Ferdinand actually never went back. He couldn't get his house. He couldn't get his bank accounts. He couldn't get anything. He stayed in a Swiss hotel room after the war for a few months in 1945. And then he died a few months after the war was over, brokenhearted. He had made a will, leaving his possessions to Maria in Los Angeles, his niece, and Louisa, and another nephew in Canada. Now, at this point, Ferdinand had no intention of donating his portraits of his wife to the Austrians, to any museum. He was trying to get all of his art back, but he was especially focused on getting back these portraits because he didn't want to now. They had murdered his friends and stolen their property, and he was not interested in giving his portraits to the country that had destroyed his world.
So he didn't sit on his rights. He actually tried to obtain recovery right after the war, it sounds like.
Yeah, he had been trying to get these paintings back even during the war.
Wow. So, and you describe Austrian extortion in exchange for exit papers. What happened? What did happen to the painting after the war?
Well, the Austrians knew they were on very shaky legal ground. They knew that they were probably, according to the correspondence, holding these portraits illegally. They'd never gotten anything signed from Ferdinand giving them possession of these portraits. They were aware that he was the owner, or at least that's reflected in their correspondence, the belief that he was the owner. And, you know, at this point, Gustav Klimt was not a patrimonial painter. He wasn't one of those painters that you had to leave in Austria at that time. He still wasn't considered that important. But nevertheless, when Jewish families came forward and tried to get their Klimt paintings back, the administrators who were the same people who had stolen the art during the war were now administrators of the Federal Monuments Office or of the museum. And they just weren't going to give these paintings back. And they fought all of these people. And so what they told them in many cases was, if you give us the title to these Klimt paintings, we will allow you to take some of your possessions out of Austria. Now, in the case of Ferdinand's family, they let them take out 20% of his brother's wife's family's estate in return for signing over the Gustav Klimt paintings to the government. Now, this was later deemed illegal, but at this time this was standard practice after the war, and this is how a lot of the stolen art was legalized.
You know, a few scholars of the Holocaust have begun to show us through their research that the bureaucrats of the Nazi era became the bureaucrats of the post-war era. And I think with your research here, you've shown us that that's the same thing happened with the Austrian gallery, where, as you said, the same people were in charge.
This was very true in Vienna because, you know, in Vienna, in Germany, they had some denazification. But in Austria, they had two amnesties right after the war, in the late 1940s and in the 1950s. And those amnesties pretty much put the nail in the coffin of denazification and allowed a lot more people get off the hook than were allowed to in Germany.
Interesting. Now, a number of events paved the way for Maria Altman, who survived, of course, and made a new home in Los Angeles. She was the one who ultimately recovered the Klimt. And you relate a fascinating story of an Austrian count who became an investigative journalist, broke the news of Kurt Waldheim's wartime participation and his deceit and cover-up during Waldheim's presidential campaign in 1986. Waldheim won nonetheless, and then it was in 1998, I think, when the provenance of an Egon Schiele painting at a MoMA exhibition in New York was discovered, and New York State's Attorney General refused to allow the painting to leave the U.S., that led to publicity that put the art world on notice that ownership of art seized by Nazis remained an issue. That seemed to open the door to the possibility of recovery for Maria Altman at that point.
Yes, well, the ensuing scandal and also the work of this journalist, Huberto Chernin, who discovered that not only did Kurt Waldheim have a dubious past, but a lot of the paintings in Austrian museums had gotten there through a dark and murky path after being stolen by Nazis. So all of this caused pressure for the Austrians, who passed a 1998 art restitution law that said that any art in state museums that was found to violate the art restitution requirements for theft should be returned to its owner. Now, one of the stipulations in this law was any paintings that had been pressured from families after the war through these famous quid pro quos, where they gave them some of their property in exchange for art, that was now illegal in hindsight. So this was the time when Maria started to look into perhaps seeking the family's art. Now, she shared the rights to the property under Ferdinand's will with Louise and Robert. Maria felt very differently than them. They moved to Canada, got on with their lives. The Canadian family was extremely wealthy. They rebuilt their family in Canada. But Maria was still very angry. They had kind of resigned themselves and put a lot of this in their past. Maria just really still felt the pain of this injustice at that time. And so she was much more motivated to go after the art than they were.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And then attorney Randall Schoenberg in Los Angeles enters the picture, grandson of the famous composer, also an Austrian Jewish refugee, Arnold Schoenberg. Randall Schoenberg becomes her counsel and spearheads the fight for her. How does he become involved?
Well, you know, he had actually grown up with Maria. Maria Altman was the best friend of his grandmother. So, as Maria always used to say, "Oh, Randy, I've known him since he was in diapers." One day, Maria had read about this this art restitution law when it was passed in 1998. So she called up his office, and she was looking for Schoenberg's mother. She wanted to talk it over with her, and Schoenberg said, "Well, you know, my mom is in Vienna right now. I'll give her a message." And Maria said, "Yeah, well, I've been reading about this law," and she listened. And, you know, they say that the Viennese and people in Europe see the Holocaust more in shades of gray, and Americans see it in more black and white shades. I think that that's probably has some truth, particularly in Vienna, where they people really do talk about it in shades of gray. But Schoenberg was, as grandson of a refugee, he had was very zealous about wanting to correct what he considered a historic wrong. At the time, this kind of case really didn't, as I say, have much hope of ever winning. But I think that he was very attracted to the challenge. He had gotten involved in some of the reparations negotiations with the Austrian government that had taken place with at the time of the Claims Resolution Tribunal. These were some belated efforts to give Jewish survivors some benefits that they should have gotten after the war. So, you know, he sort of felt this sense of mission. At this point, it would be hard to say that it would have been because of profit because, you know, I actually called up, this was in in 2003 or so, I called up legal experts and asked them what chances they thought he had of winning this case because he kept persevering. And most of them said things to me like, "Well, he's really swimming upstream." And no one thought he would win. Even when he did win, even the Los Angeles Times was blindsided by that. Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not surprised. In my previous life as an attorney, I was involved with Holocaust asset recovery, and it was, number one, it was amazing 50 years after that this effort was going forward, and it was so meaningful to the survivors. And since we were talking about hard assets, you know, this was a matter that seemed to make so much sense, right? We're not talking about reparations. This is hard assets with provable provenance. So it's quite a miracle.
His family hanging on walls like stolen property.
Right.
And me, if there was another issue also, for me, this was not just a restitution of art or property. This was a restitution of history. One of the reasons the world really knew very little about Gustav Klimt and the people who were his friends and supporters was because their art had been stolen and it was hanging on museum walls. For the Austrians to detail all of these people would have been tantamount to admitting to theft. There was a lot of material that I found in the course of this book that had never seen the light of day. These were memoirs of growing up with Klimt by a young woman he painted who probably had an affair with her Jewish mother. There were letters, all kinds of things that had been sitting gathering dust in drawers and locked up because this aspect was something that Austria really avoided. Mm-hmm. So for me, this wasn't just a restitution of art, it was a restitution of history.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can tell our listeners how the restitution succeeded. This was a matter of not only legal rights, but also politics and public opinion. How did it happen?
Well, you know, it's like Stuart Eisenstadt, the famous Holocaust justice attorney, said, a lot of restitutions don't just take place in the court of law, they take place in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. Even granted that all the legal bases are there, that that legally the burden is to return property, people don't always want to do this. Now, one of the things that Schoenberg did through this case, which really shine a light on this, not just on his case, but on others, he used the media, he set up a website, he really gave attention to this. He used the press. He was very, very good at this. But one thing that helped him quite a bit that I think kind of turned the die was that he went to the Supreme Court and he won. And I think the Austrians looked at that. He didn't win on the grounds of the case. He won on jurisdiction, on the right to hear the case in the United States. The Supreme Court said this case had that right. Mm-hmm. That was very unusual because these are events that were taking place somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So the jurisdiction was in question. And I think the Austrians just felt really backed in a corner. They could fight for years and appeal. But at this point, they were getting really a lot of international pressure and negative publicity. Mm-hmm. So the Austrians offered to allow a distinguished panel of Austrian jurors, very respected attorneys in Austria, to look at this. And the head of the panel was German. He had moved to Austria in his 20s and become a citizen through marriage and was ultimately given citizenship through the fact that he was such a distinguished legal scholar. He had written many of Austria's books on property law, and no one really knew that much about him, but he was the head of this panel, and he lived very privately. He didn't give interviews, but the panel concluded that, in a very detailed opinion that is available on the Internet in English, they went through the 1998 art restitution law and decided that this case fit the grounds for restitution, that they had violated and stolen the art. So one of the things that the Austrian authorities concluded when this judgment came out was the fact that there was a German head of this panel really affected the decision, because Germans grew up being taught about collective guilt, mm-hmm. and Austrians only believed in personal guilt. Mm-hmm. But so that happened, and Austria really had no choice. Their own legal scholars had recommended that the paintings be returned. And this was a huge case for the rest of Europe. A big collection that Holland had of Jacques Hausdegger was returned right afterwards. And I think that other European governments at that time looked at this and thought, oh my God, we could either stall for years and years and be dragged through the slime and the mud and eventually return paintings, or we could just return these paintings now. Mm-hmm. And so some of these other collections were returned at this time.
Mm-hmm. So it had far-reaching repercussions in addition to the extraordinary recovery of the Klimt portrait. Other art was recovered as well.
Yes, it did at the time, that, you know, the sensational case. I mean, since then, restitution has had its fits and starts, and there are still a lot of obstacles. And you still get the sense, as Maria Altman always used to say, they're waiting for me to die. You still get the sense that people are stalling because mm-hmm. they know that these kind of iconic people like Maria Altman, who lived through the Holocaust, who have all this moral gravitas, aren't going to be around forever, and a lot of them are already gone. And when they go, they take away a lot of the compulsion to return some of these paintings. The younger heirs just aren't as interested. They don't share the same motivation of someone like Maria. And I think, you know, probably some people are waiting for these cases to go away. But at this time, a lot of art was returned. Mm-hmm. And there was a much greater awareness and consciousness. Mm-hmm. And to the point where, in Austria, a dozen Klimt paintings have been returned since this case began. These are very important paintings. I think the one that sold for the least sold for $40 million. These were landscapes, portraits, all kinds of paintings. A dozen masterpieces that were all stolen during the war since this case began, and I think as a result of this case.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Let me ask you, looking back at what we've discussed, you suggest in the book that there's a moral lesson in this story of a painting. You want to say in a few words what that moral story is, or do you want to leave it to us to figure it out?
Well, you know, a society and a culture really has to think long and hard when they try to defend themselves with terms like patrimony or cultural property. One of the things I wanted readers to try to think about at the end is what makes something cultural property? What makes something patrimony? Did they honor the milieu that produced this painting? Did they honor this group of people? How did they treat them? What exactly is this painting a symbol of? Is it a symbol of the triumph of Jewish assimilation in turn of the century Vienna, which is always cast as the stage of Jewish assimilation? Or was it a story of its tragic failure? I think a society can only keep secrets and tell itself and others lies for so long. I think eventually a society has to come to some authentic understanding of itself. And I think that with the restitution of these paintings, Austria learned something that was very important. They learned about their own history, many things in their history that people didn't know. I would argue that was a great gift in spite of the loss of these paintings.
Well, with that framework, let me recommend to our listeners again that you read or listen to The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, by our author, whom we've had the pleasure of hearing today, Anne-Marie O'Connor. Thank you very much, Anne-Marie O'Connor. Thank you to our listeners. Please read the book and return for our next interview with an author in New Books in Jewish Studies.